This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, New Jersey says it'll eliminate the controversial park exam, but the transition will take a few years. Also, we'll hear about a unique venue for poets called Voicemail Poems. It's an online magazine and podcast curated by Amy Saul Zerbe, a poet based in Philadelphia. She'll join us in just a bit. But we start the show on a somber note with a look at gun laws. A month and a half ago, two mass killings took place in the space of just one weekend. 22 people were shot to death at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas. And not 24 hours later, nine people were gunned down at a bar in downtown Dayton, Ohio. Pennsylvania State Senator Lisa Baker, a Republican, then called for hearings on gun issues in Harrisburg, and those hearings begin tomorrow. Governor Wolf wants expanded background checks and a so-called red flag law in place, and two Republicans are now co-sponsoring red flag legislation. But Pennsylvania's legislature, which has a GOP majority, has been notoriously slow to move on most gun bills. So how might this play out? Thoughts? Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Sarah Ann Hughes is associate editor for the Pennsylvania Capital Star. She joins us now for some background and analysis. Good to have you with us, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this week, the State Senate Judiciary Committee opens up discussions about guns. And again, Governor Wolf wants, among other things, to see the enactment of something called a red flag law, which would do what, Sarah?
So a red flag law would establish what are known as extreme risk protection orders. So that would allow a person's family members or for law enforcement to petition a court to have their firearms temporarily confiscated. And a person would have to be shown to be a risk to himself or to others in order for a judge to grant one of these orders.
Both the State House and Senate, again, have Republican majorities. There are two Republicans who are co-sponsoring red flag legislation, Sarah?
Yeah, that's right. So in the Senate, you have Tom Killian, who's from Chester and Delaware counties. And in the House, you have Representative Todd Stevens, who's from Montgomery County. He's a former prosecutor. And Stevens has really been on the front lines of trying to get this type of law passed. Mainly because research has shown that it can reduce gun suicides. And gun suicides are a pretty significant problem in Pennsylvania. In 2017 alone, 993 people died by gun suicide. And so as a prosecutor, Stevens believes that these red flag laws are a way to, one, balance due process concerns with giving authorities the ability to keep people safe if they're in a vulnerable situation.
Well, the GOP majority has been very slow, you know, historically in moving on gun legislation. And again, Representative Stevens and Senator Killian are Republicans. Is there conversation about this aspect of red flag legislation, that it might help to lower the risk for suicide among other Republicans? Are you hearing anything about that, Sarah?
Yeah, so Senator Baker, who is a Republican from Luzerne County, has convened 2 days of hearings on gun violence issues. And a big part of that is going to focus on mental illness and mental health. And just looking at so they're not going to be discussing any particular bills, but she has invited a number of people who work on mental health issues to speak. But I think demonstrating your point about how the Assembly, the General Assembly, moves pretty slowly on gun issues, the House Judiciary Committee, so her counterpart in the House, has called a hearing for the same day on Tuesday for bills that would essentially sort of undo some of our gun regulations, which would make it easier for people to sue municipalities that pass their own gun laws, and to reinstate mandatory minimums for some gun offenses. So I think the House is sending a pretty clear message about what they think the priority should be. But I don't want to say that leadership in the House isn't open to red flag laws. Representative Brian Cutler, who's from Lancaster County, is the majority leader, has said, you know, ERPOs, these extreme risk protection orders, you know, we can consider them, but we have to balance due process concerns.
Governor Wolf also wants expanded background checks. Sarah, what is in place already as far as background checks are concerned?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Pennsylvania, we have mandatory background checks through a system run by the Pennsylvania State Police, which we're only one of 13 states that has their own background check system. So if you purchase any firearm through a licensed dealer, you go through one of these background checks. And if you purchase a handgun from a private seller, from an unlicensed person, you still have to go through this background check. Now, background checks are not required for private sales of long guns. And so long guns include hunting rifles, but they also include AR-15-style rifles and these semi-automatic weapons that we see used in mass shootings more and more.
Do we know what the argument is against including private checks for something like an AR-15 assault rifle?
Yeah, so Representative Cutler raised one recently, essentially that very few crimes are committed with these so-called long guns, less than 2%, according to the FBI. And so his argument, and a lot of Republicans in the House, their argument is, you know, why are we going to make a hunter jump through additional hoops to get, you know, a rifle that they want to use? You know, this is a constitutional guarantee that they should be able to have this. You know, they simply don't want to make it harder for what they call law-abiding citizens to be able to get these type of firearms.
And yet the assault rifle seems to be the weapon of choice for many who would commit mass shootings.
Absolutely. I mean, we are coming up on the one-year anniversary of the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh. And in that shooting, it was a semi-automatic weapon, was one of the weapons that the alleged perpetrator used. And so you do see a push, I think, especially among Democrats saying, you know, it doesn't make any sense to us why we should have assault weapons, why civilians should own these. But that is, I don't want to be overly cynical, but that is, I would say that's a near impossibility to get passed in the House as it's currently made up.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go into the Pittsburgh situation for just a bit. In Pennsylvania, cities and municipalities cannot enact ordinances regulating guns. Only the state House and Senate can do so, which has caused enormous frustration in Philly and also, you know, of late in Pittsburgh, which after the Tree of Life massacre decided it was going to take matters into its own hands. Pittsburgh City Council passed some gun legislation, and then there was an immediate challenge from the gun lobby.
Yeah, absolutely. So when the Tree of Life shooting occurred, you had city council members coming out saying, we're going to ban assault weapons in the city. We're going to ban high capacity magazines. And they walked back on that a little bit. They did pass an assault weapons ban, but the law says essentially this cannot be enacted unless the courts or the General Assembly tells us that this is okay. But what Pittsburgh did do, and which, you know, hasn't been challenged in court yet, primarily because it hasn't been enacted, it's not set to go into effect until next month, is its own red flag law. Pittsburgh is really, really could set a huge precedent here by saying, you know, these red flag laws aren't about regulating firearms. They're about public health. And what we're trying to do is protect public health. And so that is going to be something huge to watch. If they are able to successfully enact that, it could have a really big effect for other municipalities around the state that are trying to, you know, further gun control, but just have their hands tied by the legislature.
And yet, as you alluded to earlier, there are some members of the General Assembly who are seeking to enact legislation which would tighten or clarify state law to prevent municipalities from passing gun-related ordinances. And Republican State Senator Wayne, do I have his name right, Langerhalg? Okay, so that's in the making, too. And also, I think there's another piece of legislation from Senator Scott Hutchinson, which would not allow the governor and other elected officials to prevent the purchase and possession of firearms and ammunition during states of emergency. So it seems as if there is kind of a wellspring of opposition to any change in gun laws in Pennsylvania from some in the Republican majority.
Absolutely. It's important to note those are sort of evergreen bills. Okay. Every session we see certain Republicans introducing legislation to try to make it easier to sue these municipalities or to allow them to maybe collect for a person to sue them for monetary damages. But in Pennsylvania, even if a bill passes both chamber, Governor Wolf has to sign it in order for it to become law. And that makes many of these sort of proposals, dead in the water. They're just not his priorities at all, and are not things he would sign.
Sarah Ann Hughes, let's spend another moment taking a look at other gun statutes already on the books. Concealed carried is allowed in Pennsylvania, but you have to be licensed.
Yeah, so this is something that the Auditor General Eugene DePasquale looked at. So yes, you have to have a license in order to transport firearms in a vehicle or to concealed carry. You can openly carry a firearm without a license everywhere except in Philadelphia. But the licensing doesn't really provide any additional checks on a person. Essentially, we are a shall issue state, which means that if you meet some basic requirements, we shall issue you this license. People are required to submit references, and there are some county sheriffs that do check those, but many, many more do not.
Why not? I wonder.
Well, so Allegheny County, for example, doesn't have the manpower. They get tens of thousands of these applications and just could not manage it with the number of staff they have. Others are concerned about being sued. Philadelphia, for example, does not check references. That is because of a settlement that they had to reach. There are groups in Pennsylvania that exist only to basically sue municipalities for infringing on what they see as constitutional right to gun ownership. And so a lot of counties are, quite frankly, afraid of being sued for doing something that, they may not see as that worthwhile in the first place.
Let's discuss House Majority Leader Brian Cutler's assertion that we need to keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill. And there are experts, Sarah Ann, who say this is misplaced.
Yeah, absolutely. So, after mass shootings, we've seen this on both the federal and state level. You'll have lawmakers who say, we need to keep firearms out of the hands of people who have a mental illness. But, experts and research has shown that people with mental illness are much more likely to be the victims of violence, not the perpetrators of it. And so, when we talk about mental health and gun violence, a big part of that conversation seems to be shifting to suicides. But when we're talking about mass shootings, experts say that it's just not as useful to have that conversation.
All right. We'll keep an eye on these issues, including the red flag legislation that will be a focus of the hearings coming up this week. Sarah Ann Hughes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sarah Ann is associate editor at the Pennsylvania Capital Star. Coming right up, one of New Jersey Governor Murphy's campaign promises was to rid the state of the park exam. Easier said than done. We'll hear from Patrick McGuinn, professor of political science and education at Drew University. That's just ahead on Radio Times. Stick around. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. New Jersey's controversial and often loathed park exam should be on its way out by the 2022-23 school year. There have been issues with parks since the beginning. In 2015, after taking the test, only 47% of students across New Jersey were deemed proficient in English and language arts, and the number for math was far worse, 37.5%. And high schoolers needed to demonstrate proficiency in order to graduate. Since then, those numbers have gone up somewhat, and there are proficiency alternatives for some students. But Governor Murphy campaigned on a promise to dump the park exam, and now there is a possible end date. It will likely not be a simple transition, and we will talk about that for the next 20 minutes or so. If you've got thoughts, comments, or questions about the park exam, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Joining us now is Patrick McGuinn, professor of political science and education at Drew University. Good to have you with us, Patrick.
Thanks so much for having me.
And this note, the park exam in New Jersey has been given a new name, the New Jersey Student Learning Assessments. But for the sake of consistency, we'll just stick with park because essentially students will be taking that exam this year. So So, Patrick, why have the park exams turned out to be such an educational boondoggle?
Well, that's an interesting way to phrase it. I think I'll take the question as why has it been so difficult to get rid of the exam? As you noted, the announcement just a few weeks ago from the New Jersey Department of Education was that at the earliest, the assessment will be replaced in the 2022-23 school year, although they've also given themselves an out by saying that that timetable may even then be able to be adjusted in terms of procurement and implementation challenges, which indeed, as you noted, are likely to occur. I think it's proved very difficult despite the governor's promise during the campaign season and his commitment to get rid of the park for a variety of reasons. First of all, testing in New Jersey, like in all states, is typically done on a multi-year contract with a test administration company, so it's, you simply can't just come in and sort of void that contract. That's sort of a legal, contractual kind of issue. But more importantly, you know, federal education law, most recently the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA, mandates that in exchange for states like New Jersey receiving federal money, which is considerable under the law, they have to do a yearly standardized test in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school. So there has to be some standardized assessment. You can't simply get rid of it and have nothing there. So if you're going to get rid of PARC, as they want to do, they have to replace it, and that does take some time. And in fact, what they're doing this year is putting out a request for a proposal for companies to submit what they're calling the next generation of assessments to replace PARC, and then they're going to field test those new assessments next year before hopefully implementing the new exams in the 2022-23 school year.
Okay, so but let's get back to one of the things that just jumped out about the PARC exams. The seeming lack of ability among so many students to master the proficiency in math and language arts, experts believe those kids need to go on to college or to a career. So proficiency numbers are up in recent years. In 2018, just under 58% of students met or exceeded standards for English, rather, 44% for math. But you know, Patrick McGuinn, those numbers don't look so good on the face of it. What do they tell us?
Well, it's interesting. There are two ways to interpret those results, I think, two very different ways. One is that it's a problem with the test, that somehow it's not capturing the actual proficiency or performance of New Jersey students and somehow is understating their performance. The other interpretation is that, in fact, the tests are doing exactly what they are intended to do, that they're valid and reliable measures of student learning, but rather that that's simply where New Jersey students are. And if we actually know from a variety of other data, New Jersey typically is number one or number two in average student performance across the country, but we also are typically leading the nation in achievement gaps, right, which is a serious concern here and across the country, right? We have these very large, persistent racial and socioeconomic achievement gaps, and it's really concerning, and that's, in fact, one of the purposes of this exam was to generate this kind of comparable data where we can actually hopefully get a meaningful definition of what proficiency means, and PARC and Common Core was intended to sort of raise that bar and have a rigorous definition of proficiency, and then come up with a measure that really lets us understand the nature of these achievement gaps, where students are proficient, where they're not, both in terms of grade levels and different subgroups of interest, from a real from an equity perspective. It's very concerning that these achievement gaps have not been addressed adequately here or in most places in the country to this point.
Exit tests are said to disproportionately affect children of color and English language learners.
Do the test disproportionately affect?
I've seen that said, that exit tests, are said to disproportionately negatively affect.
Well, students, those groups disproportionately perform poorly on these tests. Now, again, whether that's because the tests are not adequately capturing their learning or whether they're not adequately being taught is a different question. We know in New Jersey, like a lot of most places around the country, right, there's an opportunity gap as well as an achievement gap. And so we know, for example, that disadvantaged students tend to, attend low-performing schools that have the least experienced, least well-trained, and least effective teachers, for example, right? So we shouldn't be surprised that they perform poorly on these tests.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the big sticking points with PARC, at least in the beginning, was students needed to get past this test in order to get a diploma.
Yes, that's correct. And that's where the accountability piece of all of this comes in and greatly complicates the efforts around raising standards and raising, and coming in with new assessments, right? So we began to, at sort of the exact same time that we were implementing these big new efforts with new academic standards and new assessments aligned to them, like PARC and the Smarter Balanced test, which is the other one, we at the same time were beginning to sort of hold teachers in particular accountable for student performance, and we're beginning to hold students accountable for their performance through, requiring the passage of PARC to get a diploma. And this was really going back to longstanding concerns that students were getting diplomas even though they really weren't proficient in math and language arts and other subjects. So an effort to sort of hold them accountable and the schools and teachers they work with accountable for the learning. But the problem there, and back to my earlier point and to your point, is that if we know that disadvantaged students are disproportionately attending less effective schools, then they're going to score lower on these exams, or they're going to disproportionately be denied a diploma, which often may be no fault of their own. And so that definitely raises equity concerns, as you know.
There has been a lot of angry reaction to PARC from teachers and parents as well. What were the concerns?
Well, boy, there are a whole variety of different concerns. I mean, part of the concern was that this was a federal mandate, and that sort of the federal government was getting itself very deeply involved and interfering in, historically, state and local run.
Because they were aligned with Common Core, is that it?
Well, because the federal government really incentivized states to adopt Common Core. There was never a mandate in as much, but the Race to the Top federal competitive grant program that the Obama administration ran really offered billions of dollars to states if they would adopt some federal, preferred federal reform options, of which Common Core and aligned assessments were two of the most important. So you ended up getting, 48 of the states actually initially adopting Common Core, and a majority of states adopting aligned assessments as well. So there was this concern about sort of federal interference in education. That was a concern. Certainly it tapped into a concern more generally about the amount of time and energy and stress that students were experiencing taking tests in general. Common Core was a very high-profile initiative, so I think it caught up in that. And teachers, while initially supportive of the idea of Common Core and these new tests, became very concerned when they were linked to the teacher evaluation and tenure process, right? And so teachers, again, were being held accountable for student learning on these tests, which some people thought was a good idea, but others, and in particular teachers, came to think of as not a fair process.
And there was a lot of concern about, quote, teaching to the test and the loss of time for creativity in the classroom.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is there, schools do give a lot of tests, that's for sure, and it's obviously very easy to hate tests, but most of the tests that are actually given in schools are not mandated, are not related to Common Core or to the PARC or required by federal law. They're tests that states or school districts or schools opt to give on their own, and this kind of gets to the question of sort of formative versus summative assessments, right? The Common Core standardized tests, they are these sort of year-end summative assessments, which are designed to sort of measure where students are at the end of any particular year and whether they meet this sort of proficiency bar. Formative assessments are assessments that are given kind of throughout the year to sort of measure student learning and student progress more finely, and it can provide more useful information to teachers to inform instruction. But, again, most of the tests that are given are really these formative assessments rather than these summative assessments.
It can be really difficult to change course. As you mentioned earlier, Governor Murphy in 2017 campaigned to get rid of PARC. The target date, for the moment, is the 2023, school year. And Education Commissioner Lamont Repillet has said this is a timeline. It's not set in stone. What are the challenges in trying to put together a test to replace PARC that doesn't look too much like PARC?
Well, first of all, it's important, I think, to note that, a lot, first of all, the Common Core is deeply embedded in the New Jersey K-12 education system and curriculum, as it is, remains so in most of the states across the country. So it's sort of interesting that while a lot of states and New Jersey now planning to do this as well, are moving away from the aligned assessments of PARC and SBAC, they're actually continuing to have Common Core be sort of the heart of their curriculum. And my kids come home every day with their Common Core aligned textbook that says it right on the cover. Right. So, you have to develop new assessments. What many states have done, and what is in fact probable that New Jersey will do to a certain extent, is these former park states have quote-unquote gotten rid of park or left park, but are actually still using many of the park questions that are on the park exam. And so the park test bank is out there for use by states, and many of them are actually opting to do so because it's so hard to change your testing system, and it's so hard to develop these new assessments.
But what might be different the next time around, even if we have an exam that looks something like park, has some of the elements of park, again, in the beginning, there weren't alternatives, correct, to students who test poorly, who weren't up to speed, who are in danger of not graduating if they didn't get through park, and now there are. What are those alternatives, and do you expect those to remain when the new test finally is put into play, supposedly in the 2023-23 school year, or 2022-23 school year?
Right. So there always have been alternative pathways to graduation. And these alternative pathways, again, people interpret them in two very different ways. On the positive side, some people say, well, these are ways that, if someone has a bad testing day or does poorly on a particular kind of standardized test, this may be an alternative for them to demonstrate their learning and get the diploma that they rightly deserve after demonstrating that learning. Others are really concerned because we know that these alternative pathways are historically used disproportionately by disadvantaged students, and there are concerns about the rigor of the alternative pathway. And so just as we were concerned earlier before in the pre-park days that the bar for proficiency and that the level of rigor of the assessments pre-park were not high enough or rigorous enough, there are concerns that these alternative pathways really are sort of a loophole that allows students to graduate without mastering the material that they need to be prepared for college or career.
Patrick McGuinn, you are professor of political science and education at Drew University, also a senior research specialist at the Consortium for Policy Research and Education. What do students need to have mastered to go on to college? And if they haven't done so, what are the consequences?
Well, the consequences can be tragic for their lives, and I think that's why so many people are so concerned about making sure that we have standards that are high and that the students will graduate with the material that they need to be successful, whether they're going on into college or not. In terms of the actual content, I'm not a curriculum expert, but there were many curriculum experts that were involved in the crafting of the Common Core. It was a lengthy process where teachers, educators of all stripes, experts, curricular experts got together and said, this is what we really think kids need to know, and they need to know this in every state in the country, right? I mean, what made Common Core so unique was we'd never had national standards in the United States, which is pretty remarkable because national academic standards and assessments are the norm in most Western countries around the world, but very new here and very controversial here, again, because of this very long-standing tradition about local control.
Yeah. Well, and if a student isn't up to speed going into college, you say the consequences can be dire. What could happen to that student dropping out, being frustrated, not feeling they can master the material? And are there alternatives on most college campuses to help these kids get back on track?
Well, we've seen very high rates, for example, at the college level of remediation. So we have students who are getting a high school diploma, showing up at college. The expectation is they are college ready, right? They're prepared to engage immediately as first semester freshmen in a college level curriculum. But in fact, in large numbers, we see that that's not the case. They're simply not ready. They require basically to be retaught the material, remediated in the material that they should have learned in high school, which they need to be prepared for college, which they haven't mastered yet. And so that's obviously an incredibly inefficient process, and as you note, it does lead to frustration and retention issues for students who struggle to adapt to the greater rigor of college, and does lead to higher levels then of dropouts with all the consequences that come for that for students later career life options.
New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware have adopted the Common Core standards. Are they working?
That's a really tough question. So it depends what you mean by working. I think there is a sense from the research that I've read that Common Core has been successful in raising the rigor of teaching and learning inside of the classrooms where it's been adopted, and that indeed, of course, was the focus, particularly on critical thinking. Part of what made the Park assessment so controversial, being linked to the Common Core, was that it was a very different kind of assessment, right? It was meant to not be the sort of bubble testing, right, that you saw in the past, which sort of emphasized rote learning, and thus if you're having teaching to the test, it encouraged teachers to incentivize teachers to teach rote learning, memorization, facts, right, rather than the quote-unquote 21st century skills that we think students need to learn, which really involves much more analytical and critical thinking, right? And so there was more writing, more open-ended kinds of questions on the PARC exam. But because it was so different, it was also administered in a very different way, right? So this was the first time in many states that we'd had testing done via computer, right? That was part of the controversy that surrounded it, and part, I think, the challenge of getting students to be to the proficiency rates that we want to see, right? These are monumental shifts when you're bringing in new academic standards, new assessments that are aligned with them, right? And you shouldn't expect that you're going to see enormous progress or enormous changes in a very short period of time. These kinds of reforms take a while to be implemented, and for the teachers and the students to adapt to them.
Got a comment from Caroline who says, I'm a teacher in New Jersey and I give the PARC test. Something people leave out when measuring the effectiveness of this test is that the kids don't take it seriously. Of course they're going to score poorly. That's something I haven't seen discussed, Patrick.
No, it's a terrific concern. And again, the irony there is that's part of why it was made a graduation requirement, right? Which is, that's how you get students to take it seriously, is for it to have meaningful consequences for them, right? So on the one hand, by making it a graduation requirement, as the state board here did, you're actually making students accountable for their own learning, but you're also making them take the test seriously because it has real consequences for them. Now we're backing away from that, right? And so again, now students will not have reason to take the test seriously, which then raises concerns about whether we're actually getting the valid and reliable measure of student learning that we hope we're getting.
Okay, so a replacement exam for PARC apparently debuts in 21-22. At least at this moment, that's what it looks like. Again, your sense of what this test will look like in relation to the PARC exam, a lot of similarities because there is no choice, or something radically different?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it depends whether you think the real issue with PARC is that it's a bad test, a low-quality test, or not. You know, many of the experts that I've talked to and the research that I've read says it is, in fact, a high-quality test, despite the controversy that has surrounded it. So I think, you know, what are we going to see as a replacement? I think we're likely to see a test that may, in fact, not be that different, but as I noted before, may literally contain a lot of PARC questions from the PARC question bank on it. I think what they're trying to do is to reduce the amount of testing in terms of the number of times that students take tests and the length of the time that they spend taking these tests. So I think we're already starting to see that, right? The Murphy administration has, reduced the number of tests that students take in high school, right? We've already seen that. So I think that's what we probably will see, is less testing and shorter testing. And also, again, more.
Unfortunately, I got to stop you there. Thank you so much for joining us. Patrick McGuinn is professor of political science at Drew University. Stay tuned. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As any writer knows, it can be challenging to get your work out there, to grow an audience for your art. Well, one unique venue seeks to give poets a platform online. The magazine and podcast Voicemail Poems offers poets the chance to read their work to voicemail and then have the voicemail published on the Voicemail Poems website and SoundCloud. Amy Saul Zerbe is a poet based in Philadelphia, and she is editor-in-chief of Voicemail Poems. She joins us now to talk about how the process works and some of the artists who have contributed. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
And as always, for anyone who wants to join the conversation, the email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at @whyyradiotimes. So, Amy, tell us more about the magazine and the podcast and how this all came together.
Sure. So the magazine was founded in 2012 by a friend of mine, actually, Jamie Mortara, who was based in Portland at the time, I think. And I joined when it became necessary for Jamie to bring on other people to help them with the magazine, and that was 5 years ago. And I have loved working on it, and it has grown. It is now based mostly in Philadelphia, but we still have editors in other cities as well. And we get calls from all over the world, which is amazing. And I am now editor-in-chief. Jamie has a more demanding full-time job now, so has had to step away from the magazine. It's been a challenge taking it over, but it's really rewarding.
Sounds like you're passionate about it.
I am.
Yeah. How does the process work for a would-be contributor?
Sure. So we have instructions on our website. What you do, there's a phone number that you call and leave. You say where you're calling from, and then you read your poem. And then you submit the text via Submittable, and we get back to you as soon as we can, and we publish issues quarterly.
Where did the idea for reading to voicemail come from?
That's a good question. I did not come up with it, but Jamie, I think Jamie would probably say that there are a lot of magazines online that publish the text of poems, but I think there's something really special about listening to the poet read their own work, and there's something really intimate about the form of reading a poem onto a voicemail. It feels very like personal to listen to it, and I think publishing that alongside the text is a really unique form.
So, Amy, what are you looking for from contributors in style, length, subject matter, or does anything really go as far as the artist is concerned?
We are looking for, we publish emerging writers. We really enjoy doing that. We are excited to have been a lot of poets' first publication. But we also publish established poets. We accept previously published work because life is short. And, we're just looking for diversity and, we're
You'll
open.
You'll know it when you hear it.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Yeah. We'll talk about the process of how you actually choose the poems, because not everything makes the cut.
No, right? Unfortunately.
Okay. But we've also got some clips from different poets who've contributed. And so let's go to the first. It's called Honey is a Verb.
This is Isabel O'Hare calling from Taos, New Mexico. Honey is a verb. She seeped into the earth, reborn as iris. Bloomed places within her that his violence could not reach, sucked into her own beautiful, flimsy piece of life. She vowed never to wish for anyone's departure, only that they be sucked into their own beautiful, flimsy piece of life. Reborn as poppy, a sleepy sort of power, the kind that lulls, a kind of tincture, a balm, a honey made from sleepy flowers. Maybe the problem is too much poppy, not enough water. She won't put cut flowers in water. They are dead already, she says. Why prolong the inevitable? She would rather be a death doula than a Dr. Frankenstein, cutting the head off a chicken to pump blood into its neck. It's not pretty. Hang it to dry. Use dead things for decoration. They tell me I killed a child once. It does not linger in a vase of stagnant water in my mind.
Wow.
Right.
The imagery is it's beautiful. It's powerful. There's a lot going on. Pain, the numbing of it.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose this?
Oh, gosh. I chose this because I think it is really beautiful. I think it's striking, and I think Isabel is a really interesting poet. She published in the last few years a collection that was erasures of celebrity apologies for assault. So she did like blackout poetry that was men apologizing for, you know, issuing public apologies. Yeah. And I think that was a very amazing idea and an important book. And I think we were really lucky to have her call us This was published some time ago, but I think it's one of my favorite pieces that we've ever published.
The voicemail sound almost adds an otherworldish quality to the reading.
Yes.
How would you describe it here?
I agree. I think it sounds intimate. I think it sounds like it's performative, but it's subtle. I don't know. It's hard to describe.
So how do you distinguish compelling poetry from work that's just not there yet?
Sure. I have a great team of editors that help me with that. We have two who are based in Philadelphia and one who is in Texas, and then another editor who splits her time between California and New York. And they are incredible as far as going through every submission, listening, and giving me feedback. And then we all vote.
Does it have to be unanimous?
It does not. But I like to make sure that everyone agrees with the final list that makes it. I like to make sure that all of our editors are on the same page, and that everyone's choices are taken into account.
And if you have to turn someone down, do you encourage them in certain ways as established poets yourselves to, you know, perhaps perfect something, work on something?
So we offer an option for getting detailed feedback from one of our editors. So that is an option that you donate $10, I believe, and Adeola Jones, who is an incredible poet, gives you feedback. We also encourage people to submit again, especially if we really enjoyed the submission, but we didn't have enough space in the issue.
So the next contribution, I should say, is called Southwest Airlines Flight Number 2003. Let's take a listen.
Courtney Lamar Charleston, calling from Jersey City, New Jersey. This poem is titled Southwest Airlines Flight 2003. The eyes have it. Wait. Such as they can't even roll. This is one of those moments when I should probably listen to my body. But you know how it goes when someone talks too much for your taste. Coffee, sir? There's lots of work to do today. There's money to be had and even more easily lost, like a sensible child to the pursuit of higher learning after high school. Time is really something, isn't it? Death is entirely something different. But I don't believe in dying, in the sense that I haven't done it yet, so I'm unsure if I can. I'm rather incompetent when it comes to handling important matters and a de facto doctorate in the trivial. I'm always the trial, and I'm always the error. If ever I felt content, maybe even happy, it was a glitch, and then it was gone.
Great line. Death is entirely something different, but I don't believe in dying in the sense that I haven't done it yet, so I'm unsure if I can.
Exactly.
It has to be original work, that which is submitted. How do you guard against plagiarism?
That's a good question. So I don't think we've had any issues with that, which is really lucky, because we've been around for like 7 years now. But I think our editors are very well-read, and if they notice any similarities between something they've read elsewhere, they bring that to my attention immediately. But we've been pretty lucky.
Two more contributions. Would like to get to them now in the remaining moments if we can. So let's go to number three.
Hi, Voicemail Poems. This is Rena Shirali. I'm calling from Charleston, South Carolina. The title of my piece is Morning and I Reconcile My Hands Again. But it was easy to picture you cupping that small phone so gently, waiting for the buzz that means I've reached back where you've reached in again, waiting to feel your gut bounce up, then down, plummeting to that depth we call a cavern, or love, or the loss of air coming easy to lungs that don't ask for it. Love, I am asking for it, and it is easy now to turn my head just so and behold a plastic cup ringed in burgundy, to run my fingers along the edge of my own body and remember, I have drowned before, will drown again, will love how an addict loves, and maybe that makes me the dumbest kind of woman. Oh, sweet morning, sweet bitter film glazing my teeth. I drink the wine, I drink the wine, I drink the wine.
So she brings us right there, doesn't she, with the burgundy and the sweet bitter film.
Yeah.
You mentioned, Amy, that you get contributors from around the world. Do you publish in their native languages?
Yeah, we have published the text of poems. We've published text poems in other languages in translation. I think a couple of times we've done that, and we make sure that anyone can call, even if they're unable to afford to call from overseas in traditional ways. I've had some callers use WhatsApp, and we just want to make sure that everyone has access to submit, and we definitely are open to publishing in other languages.
Okay, our final contribution turns Shakespeare on its head.
Hi, my name is Kevin Cantor. My pronouns are they, them, theirs. I'm calling in from New York, and this poem is called Rewrites. Romeo and Juliet, but this time Juliet doesn't text back. Romeo embraces his bisexuality, he and Mercutio kiss a lot, and no one advises a young girl to drink all that NyQuil. Taming of the Shrew, but this time, no one is expected to laugh watching a man starve his wife. And in the end, our fierce femme protagonist pulls a pin out of her fascinator, stabs Petruchio in the neck, and goes on to star in the second season of Glow on Netflix. Hamlet. But this time, Hamlet is trans, a non-binary femme doing their makeup and asking themselves to be or not to be. Because what is sitting down to a vanity and painting your hard face in its soft truth for the first time, if not interrogating your own mortality? And this time, the royal family invests in some really good grief counselors. And no one shames the young prince for crying. And the young prince doesn't gaslight their girlfriend. And no one dresses for their daughter's funeral because no one drowns, because no one is stabbed, because no one has to die. You and me. But this time, we don't define our worth by how well our bodies tell someone else's story. And we laugh until we cry. And we cry until we laugh, because the binary of comedy and tragedy, like all binaries, cannot hold us. And I embrace grief as counselor, and I am not afraid to be femme, and you are not afraid to text back, and we throw a funeral for shame, and we kiss a lot, and we drown in stars, and in the end, we glow every second of every season.
Well, we could spend a half hour on Kevin's poem there. And unfortunately, we do not have that. But a little bit of dropout in that voicemail that adds to the appeal?
Yes.
From Kevin Cantor?
Yeah.
All right. And you are, Voicemail Poems is open for submissions for the fall 2019 issue?
Yes. The deadline is October 15th.
All right. Amy Saul Zerbe, what fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amy Saul Zerbe is a Philadelphia-based poet and editor-in-chief of the online magazine and podcast Voicemail Poems. She has published two poetry collections, Paper Flowers, Imaginary Birds, and Deep camouflage. And don't forget to check us out on social media. Head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Charlie Kyer. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. Mary Cummings Jordan, thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.